from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Sunday marks 75 years since President Roosevelt signed an executive order that would force 120,000 Japanese Americans from their homes and send them to live for years behind barbed wire and monitored by armed guards. We'll learn about the Richmond flower growers, the sweet shop owners in San Francisco's Little Tokyo, and others whose lives were upended by the government. The legacy of Executive Order 9066 and its significance today. That's next on Forum. Join us. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. 75 years ago, on February 19th, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, leading to the mass incarceration of 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry during World War II, most of whom were U.S. citizens. In 1976, President Ford apologized for the government's actions, and in 1988, President Reagan signed a law giving reparations to surviving detainees, calling their internment a great injustice. This past November, shortly after President Trump's election victory, a Trump surrogate raised concerns when he cited the treatment of Japanese Americans as, quote, precedent for a registry of immigrants from Muslim countries. In this hour of Forum, we look at what happened here in the Bay Area after Executive Order 9066 and why its lessons are being invoked today. Joining me for the hour are Karen Korematsu. She's founder and executive director of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute, named after her late father, a civil rights activist who was convicted for refusing to go to an internment camp with other Japanese Americans during World War II. Good morning to you, Karen Korematsu.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And thanks also to Emiko Omori. She's a filmmaker. She did the film Rabbit in the Moon. And she was sent to the Posten camp with her family, including her older sister Chizu when she was a child. Welcome to the program, Emiko Omori.
Thank you. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Emiko.
And welcome also Ken Coca, also a filmmaker of Blossoms and Thorns, about the Japanese-American flower growers in Richmond who were interned. His parents and grandparents were also interned during World War II. Good morning, Ken Coca.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. And I'd also like to welcome Teresa Salazar. She's curator of Western Americana at the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, which has the largest collection of internment camp records from Japanese-Americans. Good morning, Teresa Salazar.
Good morning.
And actually, I'll start with you, Teresa. If you could just tell us, what does UC Berkeley have?
So many people think that the National Archives probably has the largest group of records, but it's actually the Bancroft Library. So there were two sets of the War Relocation Authority records created. One of those groups of records went to the National Archives. The other went to Berkeley. There was also, in addition to that, there was a Berkeley sociological group that was at each of the camps that was called the Japanese American Evacuation and Resettlement Study Group. So we had those records. We also had the largest group of probably personal papers from Japanese Americans themselves. And we also have a lot of the papers of the civil rights activists who would have helped Japanese Americans in the courts. So we do have this massive collection documenting all aspects of the internment.
All aspects of the internment. And interestingly, Ken Coco, what your film called Blossoms and Thorns does it also paints a picture of the Japanese American community before internment and about the community specifically in Richmond. Can you tell us why Richmond was so ideal for Japanese Americans who found work in the cut flower business?
Well, it was very well suited for growing flowers. It worked very well because people could come in, they could take a small plot of land, and really through family work, they could make it profitable. And Japanese Americans were very collaborative. They found ways to work together, to train each other, and they helped to form a flower market through the 10s to the 30s that was actually very successful.
And how did they get this on? Because I know there were laws against Japanese Americans owning land.
Many Japanese Americans were able to lease land, and then when their children were born, their children were able to own that land.
And what I found interesting was that, you know, that the community, as you depicted in your documentary, was actually quite integrated.
Yes, it's something that I hadn't really thought about until I went and I talked to people. I originally started thinking about this idea of Japanese American communities pre and post war through the writings of Toshio Mori. Toshio Mori was the first Japanese American author to be published, and he wrote a book, a collection called Yokohama, California, and it was all written before the war. And I came across these stories, and I was really fascinated to read about just Japanese Americans pre-internment. So it was not inflected by World War II. And I decided that I wanted to adapt one of these stories. And so I really wanted to explore what that community was like pre-war. And when I actually talked to people, especially in the Richmond community, they said, we were pretty well integrated. There was certainly a Japanese American community that was supporting each other, but they were also working with other people in the community.
Yeah, and they were working with Italian Americans and Chinese Americans in the cut flower business as well. And you see images of schools with lots of different ethnicities represented in, you know, school photos and things like that. Emiko Omori, this was not the community that you returned to, though, after internment. You had a very different experience of it.
I'd like to comment on something Ken said.
Yeah.
Because of this closeness and very integrated society that existed, it was all the more heartbreaking when this came down, because now friends were turned against friends. I mean, you hear stories of Issei, first generation, who
immigrated here.
Yes, and, you know, were pillars of the community and having backs turned on them when the war broke out. So I think that's one of the things that Ken brings up, is the fact that there was a very vibrant community. And Ken says that he didn't realize that there was life before camps. I was the same, you know, because for some reason, I was, you know, very young when I went to the camps. I was like 1 and a half, so I don't have hardly any memories of it. And, okay, I'm going to start branching off. You're going to have to rein me in. But this use of the term internment, having been there, I like to call it more like incarceration. Internment is a very specific term for aliens. I am not an alien, so therefore I was not interned.
You mean because you were a U.S. citizen?
Yes, because I was a U.S. citizen. Internment is really for aliens, and that's a legal term.
And I do want to get to the language and what many have described as the euphemisms, right, that were used to describe this whole period of time.
Yes.
But I think you also raise the important point that the community that you knew, the Japanese-American community, post-war, was one that was very different from the one that Ken Coco was able to reveal to us through his documentary. You had described it in your documentary, Rabbit in the Moon, as fragmented and acrimonious, and that your father grew extremely distant and quiet. He no longer had the vitality that your siblings remembered of him. And I wanted to ask you what effect you believe the camps had on your parents.
Well, once again, I was only 1 and a half, so I didn't really know the community before the camps. And I only know my parents as after the camps, basically. And I think I got to know more about my parents and their lives when I realized what they had lost, that we had a very vibrant – I have to stop using that word kind of a collective community where, like the flower growers, they helped one another. And we were very close to people outside of our communities. And the thing about flower growing, I know, just tell me if I start to drift too far. You know, we could only lease land for 3 years. So we developed an entire industry of crops that could be harvested several times a year. You know, you couldn't, like, let's say, plant fruit trees.
Right. They could grow quickly.
Yes.
And I read that your mother died a year out of the camps.
Yes.
What did she die of?
A bleeding ulcer.
And do you believe that that was anxiety induced by her experience?
There was a lot. There were a lot of cases of ulcers in the camps, and my assumption is, you know, that's one of the results of her being in camp. There might have also been, I don't know, I don't like to think about it, about possible, you know, she wasn't treated as she should have been in the hospital when she went.
Karen Korematsu, I was actually interested to know that your father's, or your grandparents, I guess, also ran a floral business. This really was a current that ran through much of Japanese American life in the Bay Area.
Yes, that's correct. There were several cut flower nursery businesses throughout the Bay Area, including Oakland, San Leandro. My grandfather actually was able to buy land before the alien land law took into effect on August 10th, 1913. And it was an industrial area of Oakland, only about three blocks away from San Leandro. And there he built the business and a home. There was a fairly large community of, you know, the Japanese and Japanese Americans in that business, because they all ended up, you know, taking their flowers, you know, by wheelbarrow to the bus, because there was no ferry then, or no bridge then, and they had to go over to the San Francisco Flower Market by ferry. So he was able to, you know, at least to buy that land. And fortunately, when the executive order was issued, he went to the bank, and one of the managers was a Portuguese immigrant who took care of, well, so to speak, took care of the land and paid the taxes, more importantly, so that when my grandparents came back, they did have that land, but it was in all wreck and ruin, and they had to start all over again.
Yes, there were, you know, accounts of bank accounts being frozen and other things that happened to people at that time. And, you know, your father, of course, is famous for challenging the order. After 9066 went into effect, he was arrested on a street corner in San Leandro. Is that right?
That's correct. Like I said, San Leandro was only a few blocks away from East Oakland. And, you know, he was there meeting his Italian-American girlfriend, not my mother, she would say, because she would have never deserted him. And someone, you know, went into a kind of a corner store to buy cigarettes, and someone spotted him. He thinks, I mean, we've never known until this day really how that all transpired. But then all of a sudden, two San Leandro policemen showed up, and then just a few minutes later, the military police. And then they arrested him and took him from the San Leandro jail to the Oakland jail to the federal jail in San Francisco.
And it was there that he met the head of the San Francisco office of the ACLU, who basically asked him if he'd be willing to be that test case to challenge the constitutionality of the government's imprisonment of Japanese Americans.
Yes, it was Mr. Ernest Besick, and he was looking for a test case, reading the papers, because he thought that the Japanese American incarceration, and I will use that term as well as we're trying to educate about the euphemisms that were used at that time. But so he read that my father was in jail, and when he came to visit, my father thought, who in the world even knew that he was there? And, you know, all of his family was incarcerated, and his other Caucasian friends were in the military, because, I mean, even my father tried to join the military even before Pearl Harbor and was denied because he was of Japanese ancestry. And then Mr. Besick said if my father would be willing to take his case and, you know, if need be, all the way to the Supreme Court. And my father jumped at it because, you know, he thought certainly by the time his case reached the Supreme Court, that they would see that the incarceration was unconstitutional. And he had learned about his rights in high school. He attended Castlemont High School in Oakland and learned about the Constitution and thought he had civil rights as an American citizen. So what I tell students is, you know, be sure to study the Constitution, because you never know when you're going to need it.
Yes. And Teresa Salazar, you know, Fred Korematsu, while the legal proceedings were taking place, was sent to Tanforan in San Bruno, Tanforan Racetrack, which used to be there. I guess now it's where the mall is.
Right.
What was Tanforan exactly? What purpose did it serve?
So when they were gathering the Japanese Americans before they were going to send them to the camps, they sent them to what they called assembly centers. And so, so there was really this makeshift housing that was provided for them.
I read it was horse stalls.
Right. And Tanforan it was, because this was a racetrack. That's what it was. And that's where people went to.
And some people stayed for several months.
Right. They did. Right. And, you know, we have a lot of documentation of the papers of, like, Yoshika Uchida, for instance. Her family got sent there.
Was she a Berkeley student?
She was a Berkeley student. So she actually got her Berkeley had sort of an interesting response. Robert Sproul, President Sproul, was actually a supporter, an advocate for the Japanese Americans. And what he did is, because he had not only students there, but faculty members, like Chiro Obata was teaching art at Berkeley at the time. And so he actually went to to Tanforan, actually gave a number of the Japanese Americans their diplomas, so they actually graduated in that assembly center. So what she documents is she's in, you know, people know her work probably Desert Exile, which talks about the camps. She was an incredible documenter, as was her father. So she not only kept diaries, and she kept every little piece of paper. So she creates these scrapbooks, so like the rations that people had to were subjected to, and she also is one of those people who does like. The whole movement into the assembly centers and all the way till the end of the camps. So she has really moving things in the scrapbook, like the fact that they're having to get rid of all of their property. And one of her prized, treasured possessions is her dog. And she has to, you know, she has a little thing with the little newspaper ad that says, "We were finally able to place Laddie." You know, just things like that that personalize the trauma that people were going through. And so, again, she was a young person. I think she was 19, 20 years old. And all of her family went to Tanforan and then later to Topaz.
And there's actually a very poignant moment in your documentary, Ken Coca, where, you know, a Japanese family has asked their non-Japanese neighbors for help watching over their farms while they have to be, you know, forced to move and live behind barbed wire. And so this is a clip from Ken Coca's documentary Blossoms and Thorns, where a brother and sister recall what happened when their Japanese neighbor came to visit soon after Executive Order 9066 was issued.
There was a knock on the door, and it was T. Ninomiya. We referred to him as Mr. Ninomiya. And so my father invited him in, and I remember he sat at the head of the table. My father moved over, and my sister and I were just the children. And I remember what Mr. Ninomiya wanted. He asked my father as a friend.
He asked my dad if my dad could watch over his nursery.
And our father said, "Yes, I will do it."
And in that clip, you also see the brother really breaking down. It also shows that even though there was this wartime hysteria, that not everybody was susceptible to it, Ken Coca.
Absolutely. It was a very moving moment, actually, recording that. I was talking to the AB family. That was the Swiss-American family that was taking care of the Ninomiya's family. And I wish I had multiple cameras when I shot it, because I shot it in a wide, and then when the brother broke down, I felt like I was too far away from it, too far away from that moment. But if you hear, he's speaking, and then his sister jumps in because he's so moved by the memory of it that he starts to cry. And this is many, many, many years after that. But those families have stayed in close contact through all of these years.
The internment camps, the incarceration camps, concentration camps, they've been called many things. Can you describe any memory that you have, Emiko Amori, of it, or that you learned as you did further research about the documentary, about the conditions there, the living conditions?
Well, because I was so young, I have been trying to get into that space.
Yeah.
And so I recently did a small version of Rabbit, and I just took images of, like, conditions in camp and put it to music. So that's a piece that will be at the Asian Art Museum opening this Saturday.
Oh, great.
It's just it's an homage to the Issei. You know, it begins with a little bit about their lives before the camps, because there's wonderful home movies of this. And then kind of the whole evacuation, that's one section. And then we get to what I call the camp life section. And it's a mixture of, like, crowded conditions and dust and snow. And it's hard to really describe it, even verbally or with images,
yes,
how it was. Because I think it was so psychological. I mean, being crammed in small spaces and the families breaking down and, you know, nobody eats together anymore. I mean,
yes,
these were like, you know, any family, eating together was a very important thing. And, you know, that doesn't happen anymore in the camps. Yet life did go on. And so there are these images of sumo wrestling, and then the American, like, baton twirling little girls.
Yes.
It's this, you know, it's American Japanese life.
It's kind of amazing, because one of the descriptions of camp life that I thought really painted it for me in a way was actually by Harold Ix, the Secretary of the Interior during this time, who told a news reporter, and this is a quote, "I saw the United States Army give way to mass hysteria over the Japanese, crowded into cars like cattle. These hapless people were hurried away to hastily constructed and thoroughly inadequate concentration camps with soldiers with nervous muskets on guard in the great American desert. We gave the fancy name of relocation centers to these dust bowls, but they were concentration camps nonetheless." This is Ix in 1946, Teresa Salazar.
Right. And I think, again, you definitely, I want to talk about, again, that documentation, because it definitely is there. You know, you see it and throughout. And again, we have this site called the Japanese American Digital Relocation, Japanese American Relocation Digital Archive. And what's great about that is it has documentation from throughout the state. So the Japanese American Museum contributed, Fullerton contributed oral history. So people can get a real sense of that experience. But you can actually see this. And one of the things that people talk a lot about is the lack of privacy. These were like barracks that people lived in, and, you know, actually, I'm losing my train of thought.
Well, that's okay. We'll have more after the break. Let's invite our listeners to join at 866-733-6786 with your thoughts and questions about this time in our history. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Stay with us.
Here in the land of Buffalo Bill, the government is erecting model camp towns, towns in which they'll live unmolested, not as prisoners, but free to work and paid by the United States government. Bathtubs, yes, all the comforts of home. The Japanese in America are finding Uncle Sam a loyal master despite the war.
That's a propaganda clip from the government that was featured in Emiko Omori's documentary Rabbit in the Moon, which describes how the government euphemistically described the incarceration camps that housed some 120,000 Japanese Americans who had lived on the West Coast during World War II. This Sunday marks 75 years since President Roosevelt signed an executive order that would lead to their forced removal. We want to get your thoughts on this part of our nation's history, what questions you have, what memories. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED.
Forum. We're joined by Emiko Omori, filmmaker of the award-winning film Rabbit in the Moon, and another version, Rabbit Left the Moon, plays at the Asian Art Museum on February 18th to the 26th. We're also joined by another filmmaker, Ken Coca, who did Blossoms and Thorns, about the Japanese-American flower growers in Richmond who were interned. We're joined by Teresa Salazar, curator of Western Americana at the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, which has the largest collection of internment camp records from Japanese-Americans, and also Karen Korematsu, founder and executive director of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute, named after her late father, a civil rights activist who was convicted for refusing to go to the camps with other Japanese Americans. His conviction was later overturned, and January 30th, his birthday was later named Fred Korematsu Day. Karen Korematsu, your father lost in a landmark Supreme Court decision in 1944 his fight challenging the constitutionality of the order of his incarceration.
Yes. Unfortunately, he did lose that Supreme Court case. However, I want to point out it was not a unanimous decision. It was 6-3, and the three dissenting opinions are probably the most studied and recognized today, and more importantly, relevant. Justice Murphy talks about racism. Justice Jackson refers to my father's Supreme Court case as this lies around like a loaded weapon ready for anyone to pick up and use with a plausible cause. Even Justice Roberts, talks about the civil rights violations. So, it was certainly disappointing to my father, but he never gave up hope that someday that he would be able to reopen his Supreme Court case, because he thought basically and simply that, he was right and the government was wrong to incarcerate 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry, 2/3 American citizens, without any due process of law.
How did he keep that hope? I mean, I can only imagine what kind of an impact that Supreme Court conviction had.
Well, he lived by his principles of right and wrong. I mean, that sounds very simple, but it's not. And he was really true to himself. Anyone that knows him, especially listening, he was this kind, gentle person that would give you the shirt off his back if you needed it, and very humble. But he felt also that both my parents that being an American citizen was to give back to this country, to be civically engaged, even though he had had a federal conviction, even though he had tried to obtain his real estate license, but was denied because of that, because he had been discriminated against not only in employment but also in housing. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to help those people who had faced those same type of situations. So my father was a member of the International Lions Club for almost 48 and a half years, was president twice at his San Leandro local chapter, involved in Boy Scouts for my brother, Girl Scouts for me, and our church. So, it didn't stop him. And he was determined, hopefully that someday, because like I said, he believed in this country and in our Constitution and wanted to not only just vindicate for himself, but all the Japanese and Japanese Americans that had been incarcerated.
Well, Eric writes, in 1942, my mother was a student at Lowell High School in San Francisco. One of her closest friends was a Japanese-American student who she never saw again after the internment camps were opened. To this day, my mother is haunted by this tragic episode in American history. And our listeners are calling in. Let's hear from Wanda in Oakland. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. My greatest mentor in life was Helen Mineta, who was the older sister of Norman Mineta, who served as Secretary of Transportation under three presidents. She was a teacher at San Jose High School, which was, even in the 50s, beautifully, beautifully integrated, multicultural. It was fabulous for all of us because we were influenced by this wonderful woman who taught us about the camps. She taught us about everything. She was a social studies teacher. She even showed us Birth of a Nation, would you believe? We came out of her, under her influence, better human beings. We understood more. I believe she and her brother were at Topaz Lake, and she never left my heart and my mind in my life.
She was a wonderful, wonderful person.
Well, thank you for sharing your memories of Helen Mineta. Let's go now to Michael in Walnut Creek. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Mina. I just wanted to bring listeners' attention to two plays that are about to be done in the Bay Area on this topic. One by Philip Gotanda, who's a Japanese-American playwright of national note, but a San Francisco resident. His play, Sisters Matsumoto, is being produced at Center Rep in Walnut Creek, of which I'm the artistic director. Beautiful play about three sisters who've returned from incarceration, kind of rebuilding their lives and, you know, facing up to the hard truths of the past, but struggling to, be, you know, to start as Americans again. And it's just a beautiful, open-hearted play. Also, Theater First in Oakland is doing a new play called Beneath the Tall Trees. So there's a lot of theater going on right now about this, and I thought people would want to know.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Emiko Omori, we heard from Karen Korematsu, of course, about her father's resistance. But one of the things that your documentary, Rabbit in the Moon, does is really document the resistance efforts within the camp. You know, we heard coming out of the break how the government tried to paint it. But help us understand the stories that haven't been told very much of resistance.
Well, I think the most famous of them, or well-known of them, would be the draft resistance. How more outrageous could it be to be, like, drafted? You are imprisoned.
Also, it just undercuts the argument that, you know, they believe them to be a military and security threat, right?
Right, right. It's hard for me to talk about because it's a huge story and to kind of condense it down. I mean, because it comes out of this loyalty questionnaire that came through the camps where, again, imprisoned people are asked to declare their loyalty to the country that has imprisoned them.
Yes, that's right. There was a test that asked them whether they'd be willing to serve in the U.S. Army.
Right.
And then another question that asked them whether they would, like, forswear allegiance to the Japanese emperor or something like that. And then there was a group of people who said no to both questions, right? They were called the no-nos. And you document how they were treated. Is there still a lot of tension, even today, between those who resisted and were viewed as disloyal at that time, and people who, say, for example, fought in the 442nd, which is a very famous regiment of Japanese American soldiers that was highly decorated. Does that tension still exist?
Well, one of the things that I learned in making Rabbit in the Moon was this division. And yes, it still exists because I think there are, you know, obviously various, I mean, everyone has a version of what happened, but what I call big kind of groups is there's the government version and then the people who lived it version. And even among the people who lived it, I guess I realized when I was making Rabbit that I had bought the government version. I bought the idea that we didn't resist and we just went quietly and then we did our duty to for the war effort. That made me feel bad about us. Like, what was wrong with us? You know, why weren't we resisting and fighting? And so to discover there was resistance was a great relief and joy. Having come out of the 60s, I mean, to me, draft resistance, that's great. You know, you should do that. So there's still tension because, partly because of the loyalty questionnaire, because people who said no were considered disloyal, and they were sent to a special, Tule Lake became the segregation center. It was just an ordinary camp, and then after the loyalty questionnaire, it became the segregation center.
And actually, we have a listener who comments on that legacy. Her name is Catherine. She writes, "My grandfather was incarcerated at Tule Lake and felt he needed to continually prove his loyalty for the rest of his life."
Yes. That's within our own community, I might add. Can I just do some shameless PR work, too? Because
quickly, sure.
This Sunday is the actual date,
right.
And there's a day of remembrance commemorative event, and it will be taking place in Japantown. And then the following Saturday, which is February 25th, there'll be films of remembrance also in Japantown, and there will also be an event at the Asian Art Museum. So there's, particularly now, because of our current president, it's become so much more relevant. And by the way, the Executive Order 9066 is very general. It does not mention a race. So I think you can...
Right. It basically empowered the military to determine how best to deal with whatever threats they saw.
Right.
And they specifically targeted
right.
this particular group. Randy writes, you might also mention that over 10,000 Germans and German-Americans were interned. Another listener writes, we also didn't accept Jewish refugees as quickly as we could have, and that was a huge, horrible mistake. Teresa Salazar, as we're talking about remembrances, I was fascinated by an NPR story that I heard about photographers who were asked to document what happened. Dorothea Lange was asked to document the incarceration process, Ansel Adams, and that the government specifically decided whose images they would publish. They ended up not publishing Dorothea Lange's because they found them to be – to showcase too much of the situation is as not humane, right?
Right?
Whereas Ansel Adams, I think he took photos of the camps and showed images of, you know, baseball games and school and children smiling. And I think in some ways I read that he was hoping that it would show that people were dignified through this terrible experience. But in some ways it created a message that this wasn't as horrible as it may
right.
have sounded or may have.
Right. And part of the context is Dorothea Lange's coming out of the Farm Security Administration and her wonderful photographs that she did of the Depression era and with a very political point of view. And she sympathized with the Japanese Americans. And also, I think it was the candidness of her photographs. They, you know, she actually caught, you know, the chaos of what, you know, people showing up at train stations with their little packets of whatever they could gather, and young children being upset, you know, people, older people being left on the wayside to wait for these buses to pick them up. So hers capture, I think, a lot of the what the actual experience was, and they're not framed, I guess, in the way that you get Ansel Adams. So, and when Ansel Adams went to Manzanar, I mean, he does this in 43, and he is asked, you know, he is purposely told not to do things like don't do the towers, don't do the fences.
Right, don't do the barbed wire.
And you know, so I would say Adams has a different kind of thing. I think he does capture the dignity of the Japanese Americans, but I also think people need to look at the other part of the War Relocation Authority photographers. Who aren't the well-known ones. And actually, that's where you get the things that I think are much more straightforward propaganda. And those are what's used for the news stories that get publicized in the film clips you see. And they have a very different character. The other thing that's interesting about the War Relocation Authority photographs is the photographers write the captions. So you get Dorothea Lange's captions on these photos, as do you get the other ones. So I think they're a really interesting sort of range from maybe Dorothea Lange to Ansel Adams to these more sort of government-formed propaganda photographs. And they're really interesting. I think people should look at them. There also are a few Japanese-Americans who actually took photographs.
And Ken Coca, you've talked or thought about how people's hesitance to talk about it, right, post their experience also may have, you know, contributed to the way that people remember it, to the degree where maybe even today someone would think that it was appropriate to suggest the time was precedent for, you know, potential plans by our current president.
Well, I think that Emiko was talking about this in her film when she talked about the horror of the Nazi concentration camps. And then people said, oh, those are concentration camps. And so by comparison, what happened to Japanese Americans? Not so bad. Wasn't quite stated that way, but it was there, that sense of it.
Actually, we have that clip that you're referring to. Let's play it now.
There are a lot of reasons we didn't talk much about the camps. One of them is the term concentration camps. We knew we had been in concentration camps. Even President Roosevelt used the term. But by the war's end, concentration camp had taken on a meaning of unimaginable horror. So one of the reasons we didn't talk much about them is not that they were so bad, but because they weren't bad enough.
And that's from Emiko Omori's documentary, Rabbit in the Moon. Let's hear from Casey in Berkeley. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to call and thank you for bringing this subject matter to attention and on your program today. And I just want to say both my grandparents were interned. And my grandfather was actually a No-No boy in Tule Lake and my grandmother in Heart Mountain, Wyoming.
Oh, thanks. Do you remember anything about their experience that you wanted to share quickly with us?
Yeah, it was just what was really interesting is that they had very differing experiences. My grandfather was in Tule Lake just by chance and then appropriately there, I guess, for lack of a better term, because he became a no-no boy. And it was definitely a very tumultuous experience for him, whereas for my grandmother, she was a teenager at the time, and it was very much more like a camp experience for her. Mm. And as much as it was a devastating thing for the family, I think it was also kind of a freeing way for a young teenage girl to experience life with other Japanese at the time, and didn't kind of kept her away from the politics and the darker side of the situation.
Well, Casey, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Virgil writes, before too many comparisons with Trump are made, consider this. If a Republican president had locked up a group of Americans based only on their ethnicity, it would have been the only thing historians talked about. But when the great liberal god FDR did it, he's given a pass and is still rated among the top two or three presidents by historians. Beth writes, why doesn't the media stress that this was done by a Democratic president rather than always making it sound like something only Republicans would do? I do have to stress that, you know, in our introduction, we did say that, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the person who issued this order. And in fact, it was Ford and Reagan who apologized for it. And reparations were under Reagan as well. Though I do want to ask you, Emiko Omori, what you think about how we do talk about FDR in such glowing terms and remember him historically so well.
Maybe.
Roosevelt.
President. Yes.
What do you think about that depiction?
Well, he did a lot of great things. You know, I have to admit that. And I am the beneficiary of a lot of the great things that he did in my old age here. You know, it was a terrible thing. And, but I guess on balance, you know, Roosevelt was a great guy.
Ken Coca, please.
Oh, I was just going to say that I feel like the salient thing is not Democratic versus Republican. It's about when bad things happen and people become fearful, they make bad decisions. And so the people have to hold the leaders accountable, regardless of what political where they fall in the political spectrum.
Yes. And you make a good point about the conditions, whoever is president, that make something like this normalized to some degree. Karen Korematsu, of course, in 1980, when Jimmy Carter appointed that special commission to relook at the circumstances around the incarceration of Japanese Americans, the finding was that it was race prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. So I want to ask you, Karen Korematsu, if you could respond to Noel's question, which is, I don't see any good outcome from scapegoating a group of people, yet too many people still resort to it. Do the panelists have any suggestions for countering this? Your thoughts, Karen Korematsu?
Well, in 1942, it was racial profiling, and that's what's happening now, is racial profiling. And it's wrong for any reason and under any president. I will point out that the executive order 9066 in 42 was hastily put together as a recent executive order regarding immigration and quote the Muslim ban, so to speak. This is what happens in times of national stress. And when my father's case was reopened in 1983, when the evidence was found by Professor Peter Irons, legal historian, and Aiko Hotsunaga Hirsig, that there was no military necessity, or as we would say now, national security reasons for the Japanese and Japanese Americans to be incarcerated, and as a result of my father's reopening of his Supreme Court case, It was found it was government misconduct. So at the time of my father's case that was heard in San Francisco at the federal court level by Judge Marilyn Hall Patel, it was shown that at the time of my father's Supreme Court case in 1944, that the Department of Justice withheld evidence, destroyed evidence, and altered evidence. And, you know, who knows what the outcome would have been if they had true picture of that time. But, you know, more importantly is that, you know, these situations are caution. And because even though my father's conviction was overturned or vacated in 83, his Supreme Court record still stands. The Supreme Court can only reverse itself. And because we had no basis for appeal, it's still considered, quote, good law, even though it's been discredited. And some people will argue, oh, well, no, it doesn't have any precedent in relationship to creating the Muslim registry. But, you know, I think it does because it's not a legal historian that's going to be making that decision. It's going to be the president, maybe, who cites the case in an executive order. And so, you know, you have to realize that, the Japanese-American incarceration was basically like a Japanese-American registry in 1942. And now we're talking about doing the same thing now. And it's, you know, that's the caution and why we all need to be, you know, vigilant to stand up for our civil rights and the Constitution. And that's what my father, you know, represents as his day and in the state of California, Hawaii, Florida, Virginia, and maybe someday nationally. Because we at least now have the ability to stand up together. You know, in 1942, there were not the organizations of voice that could challenge the government. Now, fortunately, we have many organizations, civil rights organizations, and people that just say, no, you know, we don't think that that this is right to discriminate against anyone because of religion or race or gender, for that matter. And so we need to work together to make change. And so people need to be civically engaged. That's the recommendation, to support organizations, be involved, and protest. But as my father said, when you see something wrong, protest, but not with violence. Otherwise, they won't listen to you. But don't be afraid to speak up.
Well, Bruce writes, my father organized Boy Scout troops at the Tule Lake internment camp. One of his most poignant memories was watching interned Japanese-American scouts saluting a flag-raising ceremony in the midst of the camp. Kate writes, I worry that for every one of us who is horrified that this happened and wants to prevent it from ever happening again, there is someone else who can't wait to lock up anyone they perceive as different. Ken Coca, you said that you believe something like this could happen again, but that you wouldn't have believed it, say, 10 years ago. What did you mean by that?
I think it has more to do with my own awakening to the possibilities that the government would step in and do something. I guess I've become more cynical in that regard. I believe that the tendency to scapegoat and to find a group that you can say, this is the other, and they're the problem, and if we take care of them, then everything else will be okay. I think that is something that actually works for people psychologically. They're like, yeah, that is the problem. And so it really does take a concerted effort on everybody's part to say, hold on, I don't agree with that. And right now is a really confusing time. There's so many things going on. There's so many distractions that it's hard to stay focused on. Is that the thing that I really need to be focusing on, or is it that one, or is it that one? And so that's where I start to feel this destabilization and this sense of like, oh, I'm not even sure which one I should yell about first.
Emiko Amori.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, please. I wanted to ask you a question as well.
There was another figure who, like Roosevelt, you know, is highly revered, and that was Earl Warren.
Right.
So people make decisions for the moment. And, you know, they're bad. Yeah. I know he very much regretted that.
You know, Emiko Mori, one of the things that you said in your documentary was that you think maybe the camp experience, this whole experience, actually, of Japanese internment, contributed to your decision not to have kids.
Well,
do you believe that still?
I do. And I kind of came to that at one point when I was working on a job, and we were interviewing, I wish I could remember her name, an African-American scholar, a woman. And after the interview, I asked her because it had been sort of on my mind, and if African-American women maybe chose not to have children because of the life that they are going to enter.
You said something quite poignant where you said that you did not want to have a child trapped, an American child trapped in the body of an unwanted race, which very much felt like an underscore to your own experience.
Yes. And it was so confusing being the camp experience because, what is it to be an American? What is it to be loyal? I mean, I'm still confused.
Yeah, big questions and a very complicated legacy. Emiko Omori, thanks for being here with us.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this to everyone's attention.
And thank you to you, Teresa Salazar.
Thank you.
And Ken Coca and Karen Korematsu.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for your memories and your questions. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And Holly Kernan is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.